You learn a lot about a person when you go to prison with them. I'm sure you got questions and I could explain, but what would be the fun in that? Instead, I'll just say my friend, Jane Anderson, is a multi-nominated Emmy-winning writer, producer, director who was way too busy to sit down and talk with me. But I'm so glad she did, because not only is Jane a living, breathing encyclopedia about the craft of play and screenwriting, the life she's lived as an artist, scratch that, the life she's living as an artist at the ripe young age of 70 is something we should all aspire to. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying life has been easy for Jane. A queer woman trying to forge her path in a straight world is hard enough today, let alone in the 1970s. But through her highs and lows, Jane clung to her words, and in our convo she shared how her father's belief in her empowered her to believe in herself. How the Challenger explosion propelled her to become a playwright. And why she apologized for being a dumb white woman. Hey, she said it, not me. Enjoy two friends talking honestly about Hollywood, race, and craft, fam. After you experience our conversation and Jane's work in progress, you'll be inspired to find a way to serve, to help others, and yourself. You'll know how to use the superpower of a subtext as a playwright and screenwriter. And you'll question if X-Files and the Ku Klux Klan have anything in common. The truth is out there, okay? Hey fam, I'm your host Moniece, and welcome to Works in Progress, Conversations with Storytellers.
Oh, so good to see you.
All right, should we do it?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
A kick in the gut. Jane Anderson.
Oh my God, Jane, it's so good to see you.
Okay. Here we are.
Here we are.
Let's talk craft.
Okay.
Let's talk race.
Okay. But you know what? Before we do that.
Yeah.
I just want to know. I want you to know.
Yeah.
I done some research on you.
Did you now?
And okay. What's funny is.
All right. Okay.
I had never done that before. Okay. I didn't know who you were when we were in prison. Oh, you know what? We'll talk about that. We weren't actually in prison. We'll correct that. Yeah. But you know, for the audience,
yeah,
listening and watching everybody,
yeah,
this is my girl, Jane Anderson. Okay. She is a 3-time Emmy winner.
Technically I have 3 Emmys.
Okay.
Because one was for producing.
Uh-huh.
I got 2 one night.
Okay. Yeah. 2 one night.
It was like, people like have 2 drinks in their hands.
Yeah.
You know, 2 fisted. So, yeah. So after the Emmys, I could walk around 2 fisting the Emmys. And they're heavy.
Are they?
And they're pointy.
Where do you have them in your house? Do you have them up anywhere?
Yeah, they're.
Yeah. You got them in the closet somewhere, Jane?
They're not in the closet. They're on a far shelf. Here's the thing. Here's the thing about awards.
Okay, talk about it.
It's really wonderful the night of.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe your agent sends you, you know, a crappy flower arrangement.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm a writer. The actors get really good stuff. But it's thrilling to win, but I've also been in the room several times when you don't win.
Yeah, 7 times nominated, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, everybody who watches Emmys and the Oscars and all of that, you have to understand, by the end of the night, 3/4 of the room is pissed off.
Because they've been waiting all night and they know they're not going to win, or...
Because they didn't win.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how much you prepare yourself, how mature you are, how involved and how Zen and Buddhist you are. I call it the tyranny of awards season. And I really do hate the season, because what it says is the work that you've done is only valuable if first you get nominated, and second, if you actually win. And that denies what our work is really about.
Right.
And our job as artists and writers and filmmakers mm-hmm. and playwrights mm-hmm. is to create work that moves people
mm-hmm.
and expresses something important. When award season comes around, you know, there are the snubs and suddenly everyone's the most popular, and it undermines the work.
Well, is that why you're a multi-genre artist? Is that why you do playwriting and then TV writing and a documentary? I mean, do you do that so that you can just get your stories out? Or
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And it's kind of like visual artists.
Yeah.
You know, the great visual artists worked in sculpting, painting, printmaking.
Yeah.
You know, so as writers, we want to, you know, work in all mediums.
Mm-hmm.
And each medium is very different,
mm-hmm.
very different creative demands.
Right, right. Well, I want to go back even further. Okay.
Okay.
Well, first of all, yeah. let's explain this prison situation.
Yes, yes.
I don't want people to think that we were actually doing time, but
yeah.
in a way, we were doing time, right? Yeah, yeah. So we were both volunteers for a nonprofit.
Called Right Girl.
Called Right Girl. And continue.
Teenage girls discover themselves as writers.
Yeah.
And we both volunteered to go to juvie in Santa Clarita.
Yeah.
Facility. And
yeah.
it was...
Now, why did you, we had a choice, because we could have done the workshops, the nice, fluffy, you know, the girls with the 4.0s and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
I know why I chose Juvie. Why did you decide you want to go?
Much more interesting.
Okay.
The stories they have to tell are more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I love the challenge, and I just had to do it. You know, they're fascinating, and they needed us more.
That's why I did it.
They needed us.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to go where I was needed. And I don't know about you. What made you decide to volunteer in this way? Because I had a different reason. I don't know. Let me tell you, what was yours?
To just volunteer.
Yeah, to volunteer.
Okay. In our business, there are periods of time, you know, your career goes like this.
Mm-hmm.
I had hit at a certain point, a setback in my career, where, oh God, I forget what it was. It was either bad reviews or, you know, I was not popular. And I always made a vow to myself, when the business disappointed me,
yeah,
I would go out and help the world.
You know what's hilarious? That's the exact same reason I did it. We've never had this conversation, but that was the exact same reason. I was going through a period in my career, like you said, the lulls, and I was even debating if I should stop doing this.
Yes,
the rejection was getting to be too much.
Yes.
And the only thing I could think of was helping. Like God was like, you have to help someone. And I had seen the Right Girl thing a few times, and I missed the deadline, and I just finally said, let me apply for this. And It saved me, actually, because I was able to take the pressure off of myself of being successful, whatever that means,
yes.
and pouring into these girls who needed us so badly.
Yes.
And when we had a choice to go and do the workshops at the Huntington Library and all that type of stuff, as soon as they said juvie, I was like, I'm in. Because yes. I knew those girls would look like me.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why I wanted to go there. And it was... an amazing experience.
Here's the thing about being an artist,
yeah.
writer. Being an artist, you have to be self-involved, you know.
Selfish
to sit in a room, express yourself, and it's a lonely profession.
It is very lonely.
You know, I've worked on staff. I don't love staff. I'm a
features writer or a playwright.
I worked on TV staff.
Right, but like
I'm a playwright feature writer.
Me too. Yeah.
I preferred it, but it's lonely and self-important. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It has to be self-important or else you wouldn't have the guts to keep doing it.
Right.
When you start going, oh, poor me, they didn't buy my script, or I'm getting these crazy notes, or the studio didn't support my film. It's so minor compared to what real human beings.
I know. I have to keep reminding myself that this is not real life. No. What we do is not reality. People have real problems.
Yes.
And we get to make up stuff for a living.
Yeah.
And but you can get so bogged down in the awards and the success and all that stuff, like you said.
As we all know, Hollywood is high school. It is. It's high school. And so you get caught up in I'm not sitting at the table with the popular kids.
Right.
And so that's why balancing an arts career mm-hmm. With a giving career
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
is very, very important. It makes your writing better. It makes you a better human being.
And it helps you psychologically.
Yes, it does.
It does. Yeah. It really is. So there's this whole thing about the well-being of artists in our community. People are talking more about depression and all those type of things.
Yes.
But as artists, because we're empaths and we're creatives,
yes,
we have to have, like you said, that giving part of what we're doing, because otherwise we just go down this deep, dark hole of
self-destruct.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll eat our own. Eat our own soul.
Exactly. Exactly. We don't want that. Yeah. So that's funny. We never talked about it, but we were in the same space.
Yes.
Now I'm going back even further.
Yes.
Jane, little girl. Cali girl. You're from Cali, right?
California.
Yeah. I mean, I never knew that either.
Northern California.
Yeah. So, like, tell me about your background growing up. Or did you come from a family of artists? Or what was going on there?
My dad was an engineer.
Yeah.
And moved us across the country to Northern California in the early 60s when just computers and all that magic was just happening.
Wow.
And he became one of the first gentlemen of Silicon Valley.
Okay.
But he started in his garage, in our garage,
uh-huh.
inventing things.
Right.
So I and some of his inventions didn't work, or they were great inventions, but they didn't take off.
Yeah.
And I think I learned from him of never giving up. In fact, he once sent me, I was an actor for a long time. That's even worse than being a writer because you're always auditioning. And I was very discouraged. And I was living in New York City, and he sent me a letter. And I thought it was one of those letters of, you know, Jane, you better, you know, check your bank account, or you better do that. You know, I thought it was going to be a dad thing. And inside was just this note that he hand wrote that said, never, 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 never give up.
Wow.
Love, Dad.
Wow.
And I still have that above my desk.
Wow.
And I think strong women come from dads who believe in them.
I had one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. And my mother was very arty and you know, encouraged me, but judgmental.
Mama want to make sure you can eat, Jane.
Uh-huh.
I mean, going out being an artist and being a woman as well.
And to be presentable.
Yeah. All
to
those
show
things.
Well.
Yeah. Your daddy supported you. Mom was like, I don't know about this.
No, she wanted to be an actress, so she supported everything I did.
Okay, so that was where you got the acting bug from?
Yeah,
her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you dropped out of school.
Yes, I dropped out of college, went straight to New York City.
Mm-hmm. What were you taking in college?
Acting class, but...
But you said enough of that. Let me go to New York and try it for real.
Yes.
Okay.
And I had a mentor named William.
Yeah.
Who was... He was a dancer, an older man, and he had cast me in a, he was a guest director, cast me in a production. And he said to me, if you want to be an artist, you must come to New York. You will be with other artists. You will also see more of humanity rather than being in a... Also, I was rejected from the next level of the acting program at the college. So I thought I was, you know, I was in despair. And he said, come to New York. And my parents, I don't know why, probably because my mom was a New Yorker and that was her dream, let me do it. And he mentored me. He was also gay. And I didn't know I was a gay girl because I was so scared of it and so closeted. This was the early 70s. It was still unspeakable. And the only examples of being gay were very negative. There was the Killing of Sister George movie, which was so awful and depressing. The only literature was The Well of Loneliness. Like, yeah, sign me up.
Yeah, that don't sound good at all. I want a piece of that.
And New York was just starting to pop. All my friends were either straight or gay guys. And I was really struggling to find out who I was. But in the meantime, there was theater and art, and I would just walk the streets and sketch on the subway, and I would suck up this incredible thing of New York City in the 1970s.
Yeah.
That's when Meryl Streep had just graduated from Yale, and I saw her in a very first production.
Wow, a young Meryl Streep?
Yeah, playing all kinds of parts.
Wow.
Shakespeare in the Park, and the Public Theater, and Cafe La Mama. You know, that was seeing a multiracial production of The Trojan Women at Cafe La Mama, where you were shunted around like the Trojan women, you know. And I learned what real theater was.
And is that when you found your voice as a playwright? Did you know? Were you still trying to be an actress, or you
actress,
said?
And somehow, I got cast in David Mamet's first.
Somehow, his first play?
Yes, yeah, his first big.
Wow.
New York production.
Okay.
Perversity in Chicago.
Yeah.
And acting in that play is what taught me how to be a playwright. Because no one knew who David Mamet was. No one knew that kind of rhythmic kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
And as an actor rehearsing that, I learned how to deconstruct great dialogue. And I learned also how to deconstruct subtext. And I didn't know I wanted to be a playwright, but that got into my head. And then after a couple of years, I decided I'm not built to be an actor.
What does that mean?
It means I didn't like crying in front of people.
Okay.
I didn't like being vulnerable in front of
people. Right, right. And then where do you put that afterwards?
Exactly. And I struggled with that in acting class, you know.
Yeah. So that's when you were like, enough of this, let me be a playwright?
Yes. I became a comedian.
Like the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel? Were you on stage like that?
Tried that. I was no good at that. I was more a Lily Tomlin.
Oh, I love Lily Tomlin.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, so you would do the different characters. Oh, that's so amazing.
I did characters.
That's so amazing.
Because as just an actress, as you know, I had a high voice. I looked very young. I was limited what I could play, but as a comedian, and I played cabarets in the Village, wow. The duplex.
When are you making your movie? What is going on? What is?
Oh, not that. No.
But, no, you're telling me all this stuff. This is amazing. Yeah.
But this will later go into our really deep conversation about what can you know, as a white writer, what can I now write?
Yeah.
But as a comedian, and just I had this imagination, I played an old Jewish guy. I played aging Russian ballerina. I played a hippie girl. I played a sperm donor. I played Mona Lisa. I played Shirley of, I created Shirley of Nazareth, Jesus's little sister.
Shirley
of Nazareth, a resentful little sister, right? But that whole period of time, I got to play with my imagination and perform my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then I won't go through the whole thing. I ended up here in L.A. Because I was brought out with a show. But I kept trying to push myself as a comedian playing more and more extreme characters that would be extreme for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit a wall. I was interested in, this was in the maybe late 80s, early 90s, before there was any real awareness of trans
mm-hmm.
women.
Right.
And I got interested in men who felt they were stuck in the wrong body. And I started writing this kind of character. And I tried to play him, her, and I realized I just couldn't do it. And that started becoming a play, which eventually was Looking for Normal. And it got produced at the Geffen Playhouse.
Right.
And HBO, Colin Colander at HBO saw the play and he said, Jane, would you like to write and direct this as a film?
Mm.
And that became Normal with Jessica Lange and Tom Wilkinson. Yeah. So, and then also I became a playwright when the Challenger blew up. And, I'd come to L.A. and I wanted a real writing job. And I got like a day job, acting job on The Facts of Life.
I saw that and I geeked out for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, The Facts of Life.
Yeah.
And I had my spec scripts
for
other shows.
Yeah.
And when I was done, I went to the producer. I said, I kind of lied. I said, I really love your show. I really didn't. But I said, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And they read my spec script. And that week, they had just lost two of their female writers.
Oh, wow.
So they hired me.
Wow.
And that was my first writing job. And what really pushed me into playwriting and film and more serious work, I was getting ready for work, to go to work there one morning, and I was watching the takeoff of the Challenger. I loved space, and I was so intrigued by this goofy teacher. You know, she was so great and ordinary. She won the lottery. She's got to go into space. And I watched the Challenger blow up in front of my eyes.
Yeah.
Live.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought, A, I have to write about this. And two, life is too short to be working with these people who offend me every day I go in there.
Right. Like there's got to be something better I can be doing with my life.
Yes.
My purpose.
Purpose.
Yeah.
So I started writing a monologue for, I was intrigued that the teacher left a little girl and a little boy, especially a little girl who was only 3 or 4 and didn't get it. So I wrote from her point of view, and then I started adding more, and that became my very first play, Defying Gravity. And that since made it to New York and still gets done. But I guess the reason I'm telling these stories to you for your audience and for people who are starting out as writers, follow your moral gut when you write. We all have to do those hard, crappy jobs.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I was on The Facts of Life, because what it did for me, it taught me how not to be precious about writing. Because you write a scene, you show it to the showrunner, no, try this and this. You throw it out, you write it again. Because I came from New York and I was precious.
You were artiste.
I was an artiste. And you need that. You need experiences like that to teach you how to be a pro and how to work with other people, how to be able to rewrite in a heartbeat.
In a heartbeat, on a dime.
Because our first drafts are never good.
Mm-mm. And that's everybody.
Everybody.
Everybody's first drafts suck. So that's something else. That's the reason why I want to do this, because talking to people, all these different levels and experience and stuff, like we all start with a blank page.
Yes.
So it democratizes everything, whether you have an Oscar or an Emmy, and everybody's first draft sucks.
Yes. Mine are so bad. And, you know, but and the wonderful thing about being a writer and working alone, no one has to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I'm in rehearsal with actors for one of my plays, I realize those poor actors have to make their first draft mistakes
in front of
the director and the playwright and the other actors and the stage manager.
Yeah.
We get to do ours privately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all those stories, because it tells your journey. Your dad telling you never to give up, and you're doing all these different things, and you're hitting these walls, and it's like a ping pong. You're just ponging over here and doing all this. But it all comes together. You've written in genres. You've written as a playwright. You've written as a TV staff writer, as a filmmaker. I mean, how do all those different genres feed on each other or help each other?
They do. They just develop your craft.
Okay.
It's all about craft.
Yeah.
And the craft of playwriting, I will begin a play off of just an idea or start writing a monologue, kind of like a poet just starts off of imagery.
Mm-hmm.
A screenplay, I always do multiple outlines.
Yes.
Because screenplays are architecture.
Yeah, and it's not a lot of real estate. You really got to know where you're going. There's no wandering in a screenplay.
You cannot wander.
No.
And I did try writing one without an outline.
And it was a horrible experience, I'm sure. Yeah. And then the TV staff writing, I just recently got my first TV staff writing job. And I come from you, like you, as a playwright, as a poet, as a novelist. I'm used to doing everything myself. So being part of a group and having to be part of the think tank and to talk your ideas out loud was such a major learning curve for me.
Did you like it?
No, not really. Not particularly. But I understood why it's necessary, because TV is like factory work. You know, you got to get the script out. Like you said, you cannot be precious about the words because you tell showrunners, I don't like that. Okay, let me come up with something else. So it taught me how to pitch constantly.
Pitch your idea for your episode.
Yes. And then to not be precious. Don't take it personally.
Yes.
Always have another idea ready to go, two or three ready to go.
Yes.
And how to write very, very quickly. So it's made me a better screenwriter and a better novelist because now I know I can write really fast.
Yes.
And the first draft is going to suck. So don't worry about that part.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're not built for that, for staff writing. Some people are. And they
I think they're brilliant. They're brilliant at that.
They can come up immediately. They can punch something up. And the staff writers I know feed off of the communal energy.
Yes.
And that's incredible. So,
hats off to them. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a skill set. It's definitely something to be applauded. The people who are really good at it, they're amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a writer, you find out which kind of writer you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once you find that out, just go for it.
Just go for it. Yeah. Just go for it. So now.
Yes.
Let's talk about race.
Okay.
I wanted to let my people know who you were and your experience so that they would have context for the conversation that we're going to get into that's really deep.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
Well, so I was saying to you before.
Yeah.
When did we first meet? It was 10, 12 years ago?
Let me see. It's easily 12. It might be 13. It's been over a decade for sure.
Yes. It's been over a decade and I remember when we would work together or we'd take these wonderful hikes with all the group. And you.
Shout out to the van.
Yeah.
Shout out to everybody.
And it was still a time when nice, liberal, white ladies like me didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And what kept us from really getting it was because we were so damn proud that we were liberal.
Yeah.
And don't have a racist bone in our body, but the cluelessness I remember that I had. And I think it was culturally with Black Lives Matter and finally, the greater white culture was finally being taken by the scruff of the neck and said, listen up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I even said to you when I apologize for all the white.
Yeah, dumb white woman stuff you said. Yeah.
So I remember we were talking about way back then.
Yeah.
Detroit. Which was directed by Kathryn Bigelow.
Mm-hmm.
And it just come out. And I said, oh, yeah, I thought it was a really good movie. What did you think? And you said, eh. So I want to know, talk to me what was wrong about it for you.
I mean,
or inauthentic.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like what we were talking about earlier, that it was from the gaze, it was from the white gaze.
Yes.
And so it just wasn't authentic to what Detroit I know, the people I know. It wasn't authentic. It didn't feel real. It felt like a white person telling the story. And a lot of times that's what happens with our stories. They're told from the white gaze and they're whitewashed to be palatable for the audience, for the white audience to get. So it wasn't for us. So I can understand why y'all would like it because you know exactly what they're doing. They're appealing to you.
What was can you remember what was particularly white gazey?
I think it goes back to what you were saying before. When the white gaze is the point of view of a story of a Black person or a brown person, there's no subtext.
Yes.
There's no subtext. It's just straight stereotypical surface stuff.
Yeah.
And so for me with Detroit, I mean, we had the racist cop. We know that dude,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then we had the Black guy from the hood or whatever But there are no layers to his background, his personhood. There were no levels to it. Yeah. And so it was just really flat. Yeah. It's like, you know, you could just look up something on Wikipedia and decide, okay, well, this is what a black person from Detroit at this time would do.
Exactly.
And then you do that.
Yeah.
And then you direct the actor to do that. Or it's in the writing like that. So when people aren't from the community that they're writing about or directing about, there is no subtext to it. There's no... Denzel Washington did an interview once about when he was directing Fences, and he was like, could Steven Spielberg have directed Fences? Of course. No, he said he could.
Yeah.
He said, but it's about the culture.
Yes.
You need someone from this culture.
Yes.
You need someone that has the picture of Dr. Martin Luther King on the wall, because that's what happened in every black kitchen at that time.
Yes.
But I know that because I'm from this culture. So it's those little sprinkles of salt and pepper and things that they don't necessarily know or even think they have to know. And so it doesn't ring true.
And you would hope that, for instance, the actors, the black actors in Detroit would have said in rehearsal, I don't know if they rehearsed in rehearsal, you know, let's try this way of going at it. Or, but I think sometimes actors, when they're, you know, just coming up in their career, will just, they're just so happy to work.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, so I'm surprised, you know, there wasn't that going on.
Yeah.
You know, a real dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a good transition into your piece then.
Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about what you have. Thank you, first of all, for sharing this piece. I mean, it's just wonderful. You know, I'm reaching out to people that I love and respect in hopes that they're open enough to be vulnerable to show a work in progress. Because we all know, we just had a whole discussion.
Yeah.
Like, we don't want our stuff to be seen when it's not finished yet. But I think it's important that our audience and people who are writers or want to be writers or thought that they can't be writers understand that, you know, we all go through the same thing when we're creating things, and there's a process to it. So I wanted to thank you for that. So now tell us all about it.
Well, actually, this scene is pretty finished.
Okay.
It's from a script that's now the producers and the director taking out to get cast.
Oh, that's even better. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So it's on its way.
Okay.
But I was approached by a wonderful white director, an Australian director, if I'd be interested in writing the screenplay for a movie about Benny and Barney Hill, who were real people. They were an interracial couple. Barney was black and Betty was white, and they lived in Portsmouth, Maine, and they became famous in the early 1960s for being abducted aboard a flying saucer.
Right.
And this whole, it was crazy.
Mm.
The story took off.
Mm-hmm.
And they became famous. Not only that, James Earl Jones in the early 70s bought the rights to the story.
Oh, wow.
And they did a film.
Okay.
He played Barney Hill.
Oh, wow.
And you can watch it on YouTube.
Okay.
It's like one of those, you know, black and white films you see on, you know, television playhouse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. PBS situation.
Yeah. And so I started researching and just reading everything about them, and they felt, the story was that they were returning from Niagara Falls
yeah.
on a belated honeymoon.
Yeah.
And they were going through the White Mountains of New Hampshire, which are craggy, and it was middle of the night. And they saw a light in the sky, and it started following them and following them. And then Barney got out of the car, and he looked through his binoculars and freaked out, and Betty was freaked out. And then suddenly they couldn't remember anything. And the next thing they could remember, they were driving home, got home at 6 a.m, 2 hours later than it would have taken them. And they felt dirty. They felt unclean. They felt that something had, and Barney had scrapes on the tops of his shoes. Betty had a torn dress. So what started happening? Betty started having dreams about being abducted on the flying saucer. And her dreams were so clear and vivid and repetitive, she was convinced by a couple of people that this could be repressed memory. So she started creating this. I said to everybody after I went through all this, I said, you know what? This really is a metaphor about racism.
And yeah.
I suspect that they were actually stopped on the road in the middle of the night, and the unspeakable was done to them because it was a very, they had stopped at a coffee shop in the middle of the night, white people there. I think my theory for writing the screenplay is this actually happened, and it's much more tenable to believe that they were abducted by a flying saucer. And Betty, being white, as she kept retelling the story, they became friendlier and friendlier. And Barney
was internalizing all of. So were you able to channel your own white woman cluelessness?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
One of them, I actually read that Betty and Barney said that when they were driving through the White Mountains, they stopped for coffee, and they were being served by a light-skinned black woman, and Barney she wouldn't talk to Barney, and Barney kept saying, you know, she won't talk to me because I'm black and they're white people. And Betty actually said, oh, Barney, quit being paranoid.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a tired waitress. You know, she would do this because she wanted him to feel comfortable. And that's, I think, what a white spouse, white friends do. And when I remember those years ago, we were taking a hike through Griffith Park.
Yeah.
And it was a bunch of us white writer women. And you were the one black woman.
Yeah.
And you turned to me and you said, "What? Tell me what you said." You said,
I said, black people don't hike. I said, it's because, you know, we don't feel safe in these outdoor spaces because we're always being watched.
And I said, what? You're safe? Come on. And my first impulse, I didn't want you to feel that because I wanted you to have fun with us.
Yeah.
And I denied it on you.
Yeah.
You know? And I apologize for that because I was being a stupid, clueless white woman. And so I remembered that moment as I wrote Betty.
Wow.
And actually, the scene you're gonna play.
Yeah.
It's integrated into that.
Wow.
And you'll see the argument.
Wow.
So going back, I was a white screenwriter. We had a white director, white producers, and I wrote a couple of drafts and thought it was pretty good.
Mm.
And you're going to love this. I showed it to Fran McDormand, my buddy Fran.
Oh, yeah.
And because we wanted maybe her to play Betty.
Yeah.
And she called me up and she said, Jane, it doesn't work, Jane. You're a great writer, but you're white. You can't write this.
Mm.
You can't do this. Because I had written a whole scene with Barney and his fellow NAACP. And I knew I couldn't. Yeah.
Something was missing.
Yeah. And she almost said, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
Jane, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
So I called up the producers and I said, you know what? I'll drop out. If you want to get a black writer, you know, this isn't right.
Yeah.
We're going to get creamed. I don't want to be the next Green Book.
Mm. No. No.
I knew when I saw, last of its kind. And everybody talked, and they decided to keep me and hire and find a great black director,
mm-hmm.
who could guide the project.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, they found Roger Ross Williams,
mm-hmm.
who's, I urge everybody to look him up and watch his documentaries.
Right.
They're fabulous.
Right.
And Roger really, he took to the script because he said, I'm a Barney. Because Barney lived in his black community in Philly with a black wife and their kids, and they divorced, and he fell in love with white Betty and moved to an all-white community, and Roger understands that sliding back and forth between black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his friendships are white.
Mm.
He lives in a very white community, and he said, you know, I'm feeling that isolation.
Mm.
Almost guilt, almost, you know, what am I doing?
Right.
So when we started just talking, he could inform me,
mm-hmm.
of, I suspected, I knew in my gut really what Barney was feeling, because again, as a gay person, I've had to translate, you know, live in a straight world, translate, get along,
mm-hmm.
it's fine. It's nothing compared to being black in a white world,
but mm-hmm.
I kind of know how to access that as a writer authentically.
Right.
But it's vitally important that I understand on a deeper level from Roger, you know, really what it is.
Right.
And all the subtle things. And so I was able to also write I wanted to write a scene where Barney goes back and talks to his son.
Mm.
You know, as a man who's left their mom for a white woman. Not only that, a crazy white woman.
Yes,
which makes it even worse.
Yes, she's
crazy. Ass white woman who believes in flying saucers. You know.
Exactly.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, let's take a look at it.
Yeah.
And see what our wonderful actors did.
Interior. New York hotel room, early evening. Betty and Barney, back from their taping, are coming into their elegantly appointed hotel suites, a far cry from their Niagara Falls motel room.
What was that stupid crack you made about my sister?
What about it?
It wasn't funny.
It was a joke.
It wasn't funny.
And neither is that joke you're always making about my dentures.
It's not a joke. It's part of what happened.
I don't need people to think I'm someone who can't take care of his teeth.
That's not what they're thinking. And you handled it very well by explaining about the grenade.
And then you had to tell him that it wasn't in combat, but while I was at the base.
I said you were training soldiers. What's wrong with that?
You made it sound like a grenade went out of my control on my watch. It made me look incompetent.
Barney, you're gonna have to get over this persecution complex of yours. It's wearing me out.
This skin of mine is not a complex, Betty.
Oh, come off it. Look at all the people lining up to shake your hand. I promise you, no one is looking at your color anymore. They're looking at you with awe.
You can't be serious.
What's the point of us even talking if you're going to tear down every positive thing I have to say to you?
You're so goddamn clueless sometimes, Betty.
I am your number one defender, Barney, so don't pull that crap on me.
Then listen to me for once.
The phone starts ringing. They both stop yelling, suddenly aware that people in the hotel might have heard them fighting. They listen to the phone ring for a couple of beats, then Barney picks up.
Hello. All right. Thank you.
What was that?
Our limo is here.
We have a limo waiting for us.
Correct.
To take us to a dinner in our honor at a fancy restaurant in New York City. So why the heck are we fighting?
I can't believe all these people are taking us seriously.
Honey, you have been fighting to be taken seriously your entire life, and you're finally being treated with the respect you deserve.
Respect for what? For being abducted by aliens?
For being the amazing, intelligent, handsome man that you are. Come here, you.
Betty and Barney kiss and make up. Then Betty straightens his tie for him.
You are something, Barney Hill.
Oh, really, really interesting. I see at the end of that scene, I didn't quite put in the stage directions when they're done fighting, because, you know, the fights really gets heated and it's very deep. Their resolve is a little too fast. I think on Barney's end, I would write in the stage directions for the sake of the actors, or the actors will find that in rehearsal, is that Barney, when Betty starts saying you're an amazing, wonderful, incredible man, you know, it's that doesn't totally buy.
So that's something that you add in the revision. You write more stage direction to give the actors something. Okay.
Yeah. So it doesn't. Right now, it just feels like they resolved it.
Right, right.
And it's not resolved.
Right.
And that's something you never know how your director and actors are going to, or your producers when they, or execs are going to interpret your script. And sometimes I'm there in rehearsal and we'll say, you know, it's not resolved. But if you're not there as the writer, you need to just give a little guidance.
But there's a fine line, though, you know, because you're a writer and a director.
Yes.
So
and you don't want to over.
Exactly.
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 You don't want to get in the way of the actor's discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an interesting craft thing you brought up, that you can't over direct in your scripts. You can't tell you can't write every camera angle, because it doesn't give your cinematographer and your director room to see their own vision. And you can't overwrite a script. However, when you first turn in your script to producers,
yeah,
and executives,
right,
studio executives, and even your own agents,
uh-huh,
they almost skim through a script.
The actions, yeah.
They don't see subtext. So you have to hammer it in a little bit. And then sometimes when it's time for rehearsal or production, I'll take some of it out.
Oh, okay.
To not insult the actors.
Ah.
And give them, you know.
That room. Makes sense.
But it is a balance.
It's a delicate balance.
Because many times I'll have the scene in my head, and I'll just write the dialogue, assuming everybody gets subtext. And often the dialogue will look very ordinary,
mm-hmm,
and then I'll I'll have an executive read it and say, and then say, well, you know, nothing really went on here.
Right.
Or, you know, this character, I don't understand what they're getting at. So you have to let everyone in on what's in your head.
Mm. So how can you be a champion or a protector of subtext? I mean, this is like a really deep craft, mm-hmm, conversation, because like you said, you can't overwrite. You don't want to insult your actors. You don't want to insult the DP. But you almost have to, like, feed it to executives like baby food, so, mm-hmm, you can get to the point, mm-hmm, where you can collaborate with people, mm-hmm, who understand subtext. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the tricks that you
sometimes
do?
Sometimes what I do, often I talk about, I use point of view.
Okay.
And point of view is in the directions, I'll say, from Barney's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
He sees some white hoods and black leather jackets looking up at him. And that, in a way, is a camera direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an emotional direction, mm-hmm, because all camera work, good camera work, is just taking the audience through the psychology of a scene.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So you'll notice, you know, a film there will be a cut of a close up of, you know, a hand,
mm-hmm,
a nervous hand, or and you can write that kind of stuff into the script without. It's like tracking left, right, to, you know.
Not like that. You would just say, and yeah, Jane, yeah, taps her hand nervously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or if you want to, if that character is alone,
mm-hmm,
or if it's a scene between two people and the other person notices the tapping. Because that says something about the dynamic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then for actors, I'll often write stage directions if I really want to explain what the scene is about and what's really, mm-hmm, going on. I'll get a little novelistic with, mm-hmm, my stage direction, mm-hmm, you know, kind, mm-hmm, of a little poetic or a little. I won't say Betty screams crying or Betty laughs, because no actor wants to be told they have to cry or laugh.
Mm.
I will write something like, this is a kick in Betty's gut.
Mm.
So that kind of clue
mm-hmm.
will tell the actor what's going on, and the producer, and the director.
And it gives them a way to interpret what...
What to do with it.
Yeah.
Instead what do I do with getting kicked in the gut?
Exactly.
But it's a map.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That was just a master class in subtext. Oh. I just want you to know. I'm like, can I take notes? She's teaching me something. So that was really great. I think that everyone's going to learn so much from that. And then hearing you talk about what you got from it.
Yes.
That's so brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's, you know, nothing's ever really finished.
No.
It just gets shot or just gets staged. Or like Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, he had a quote when he said, like, we don't put up the show on Saturday night because it's finished. We put it up because it's Saturday night.
That's exactly right. Yes. Well, and as screenwriters and television writers, we have to understand our words are not inerrant. It's not Bible verse. You know, we are handing something over to the next set of collaborators. And I also learn a lot when during auditions, you hear the same scene over and over and over and over and over again. And that's when I hear a lot of the flaws in the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I do a lot of rewriting after auditions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I see, you know, and that was so valuable to see how that scene played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how, you know, I think there's a slight flaw in the writing in the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or maybe not. I don't know. Something to discuss with Roger and the actors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for this, Jane. You've dropped so many gems in our conversation. I just wanted to ask you, like, if there's anything else you wanted to share with our audience. Any more advice? Any more wonderful nuggets that you could drop?
Just be kind to yourself.
Because
we all have that judge in our head that collaborates with the judges out there.
Yeah.
And don't let that judge collaborate with the people who are putting you down. You know, and it could go way back to childhood. Or I always hear, I've gotten some really terrible reviews from New York theater critics. You know, they don't belong in your head while you're writing. And then when you read your, what we call the crappy first draft, you're going to hate yourself, but be kind to yourself. Look, read it the way you would read a fellow writer's script, because you would never turn to me, and I would never turn to you and say, God, what are you, a moron?
Right.
A moron for writing that scene? That's right. What we say to her. We would never do that. We'd say, yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't play yet. Doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Do that for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Be kind. Be kind.
Be kind.
Be kind to yourself.
Oh, Jane. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I love that we could have these deep, honest conversations. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Bam. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for supporting Works in Progress. See you next time.